Welcome to the Smart Dating Academy podcast. I'm Bella Gandhi, the founder of Smart Dating Academy and your host. I started Smart Dating Academy in 2009 because I had this crazy knack of giving people dating advice that actually worked, that I took. I've been married for almost 25 years, and now my company helps people to date smarter and to find love. This podcast is meant to bring more love into your life, no matter where you are and what you do. And we're here to bring more life into your love. Smart daters, welcome back to the podcast. I am so excited to have my good friend, Dr. Justin Garcia, on the podcast today. And we're going to talk about all things SEX, sex and dating. And for those of you who might not know who he is, Dr. Justin Garcia is the executive director of the Kinsey Institute, and he is a scientific advisor to everybody's favorite app, Match.com. Justin, welcome to the Smart Dating Academy podcast.
Ella, it's great to be here with you and with everyone. I'm honored to be on, and thanks. Well, happy to talk about anything.
Well, first of all, Justin is recently engaged to this amazing woman. And just for any doubters or haters, tell them how you met.
We met like a majority of singles meet their partners today. We met on an app. So we met, we were living an hour apart, and we met on an app, and there's a little town in between where we live, Nashville, Indiana. It's kind of one of those like fudge and coffee kind of towns. And our first day was there. We met halfway. And actually, we just went back 2 weeks ago. We went, we hadn't been there in a while. We were like, oh, let's go down romance memory lane.
Oh, I love that. So the apps can work.
Mm-hmm. They can work. They can be tricky. They are tricky. I think for me as a behavioral scientist, the challenge is that they don't really align with the way we process information. It was particularly in the mating context. It's in some cases, it's too much information for people, but they do work. And I think that especially now we're seeing a lot of criticism around the apps, a lot of important questions about safety and comfort and gamifying our relationship early choices. But they do work. And according to our data from our national study we do, the Singles in America study, more people have met through an app or a website than any other context, more than friends and bars and family. So they can work. And actually, a lot of the long-term research suggests those relationships are just as stable as ones that meet offline.
Right. Because, I mean, Match has been around since 1995.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's so much has changed. I think, as you know, you've been in this business, a leader in this business for so long, that early on when people were using the apps, there was so much stigma, sort of like, why are you turning to it? But as more and more of our lives are happening online on our phones, it's a natural way to integrate dating into our everyday life. The challenge, though, the big challenge is the amount of information. And sometimes psychologists will call it cognitive overload. And there's different ways people will describe it. And then it's sometimes too many choices. And the way I often think about it is, you know, I go to this one restaurant and the menu is so long. And each time I go, I think I'm going to try something new this time. I'm going to try something new. I'm going to get the salmon. I'm going to get this. And, you know, I've gotten the same salad for 15 years. And it's because there's so many options. I kind of get overwhelmed when I look at this menu. And I said, well, I know something that works. And that can happen to all of us on the dating market. You go on these apps, you see 1,000 people, and you start saying no to things, or you rely on something that's overly familiar because it's just a flood of information. That we have difficulty. You know, humans didn't evolve to have 2,000 mating options in 15 minutes. And so it could really be a struggle. So we have to use the app smartly.
What was it like for you as a scientific advisor to Match, knowing the gizzards of the algorithms, and then you go home and you become a consumer on the apps? How did you reconcile all of this?
I love it. I love that you ask. And it's, as you know, some of our friends at Radji, when I first went on, I said, do I have to disclose? Do I put this in my profile? At what point do I say? I don't want people to think I have access to information that I didn't have access to. It's interesting. I think it's humbling. And it's I think for all of us in the space of love and sex and dating. And you can know all the ingredients that go into a cake. It doesn't make it any less delicious. And so I think it's still fun and at times a threatening response. You know, sometimes dating can feel overwhelming and stressful. I think it's fun as we get to meet new people. And so I think on the one hand, I was maybe more cautious because I was a little bit more careful about, you know, what could that really mean? Or why did you really have a picture like that? Or I know better. I know what that dog in your picture, what you're doing there, because I published that paper. So I know exactly what you're doing. And so
but you're dog fishing me.
Yeah. And then, but then there were other times that I think it's a good reminder that all of us, it's the thing that unites people all over the world, of every age demographic, of every religion, of every culture, of every race, is that we, the great pursuit of love. And so I think for me, it was fun. It was actually a lot of fun. And our first date was, I told her early on that I had worked for some of the apps, but when I was younger, when I first started using the apps many years ago, I had used it and I went out with someone and it was in town and I had given a talk not long before. And the server said about halfway through our date, said, are you the Kinsey guy that works with Match? And my date at the time was like, is anything you care to share? So it's a little bit about my career, I should tell you.
Right. Are you recording this date? Yeah. Is everything data to you? Am I like an N of 27?
It's all data. It's all, it informs our worldviews and our, and actually in some cases, I've had a study or two that's been informed by real life.
So. Right. Exactly. You're like, I had a friend that went on this one date. Right. Experiences are data at the end of the day. Right.
Exactly. And they inform our, I think the thing that's important for us as researchers to always remember, and I think we often forget it, is there's so much variation. There's so much diversity in what can happen on an actual date, or sometimes what we expect isn't how things turn out. So the real world, really being out there and doing it, is just a great reminder of, well, I didn't think about that, or I didn't think I'd react the way I did to what this person said.
So last question about, you were on the apps. It sounds like you did a few go around, so it didn't happen for you right away.
No, I did. I did them shortly after when I moved here, when I first moved to Bloomington, I was in my 20s and I didn't really know anyone in town. So it was also, I came to the Institute as a postdoc and everyone was so much older. Most of my colleagues were married. So I didn't really know anyone. So actually at that time I used them and I used more than one, as most Americans do. As we know, most people are on three at a time. And but I used them and I met a lot of people. And some of those people I still stayed friendly with, and got to know town. I got to know what coffee shops I liked and what lunch spots. And then I stopped for a while. And then I was in a relationship and then I was out of one. And then this time it was also interesting because it was a very different experience from the last time, like when I had used them previously. So it was at a different point in my life and my career. And I think also the things I wanted in relationships were different.
Totally. And that happens to us as we move through life and gather new experiences. We know ourselves better and we have these experiences with other people. And sometimes they're like, oh, I love that about that person. Or it could be, wow, that was a 5-alarm dumpster fire. Never doing that again.
Yeah, exactly. And that, it's one of the things in our studies we've seen that we've been doing some projects on aging and dating and aging and sex. And
ooh, let's talk about those.
Yeah, you got it. And one of the takeaways, though, is for older Americans in our studies, they've had more experiences so that they're a little bit more honest about kind of upfront saying, hey, I know that doesn't work for me. But then on the other hand, saying, you know, a little bit clearer, they tend to be much clearer on what they want and saying, you know, I want a partner that can do X, Y, and Z. Whether that's someone to play tennis with or someone to travel with or someone to meet your emotional needs, just the sort of clarity that comes with the time and experience.
That's so interesting. You know, it's funny when people come to me saying, I want someone to play tennis with. I'm like, okay, you've been single for a long time. How have you been managing your tennis game? They're like, well, I'm in a tennis group. I'm like, okay, so the lid to your pot might or might not play tennis. Can we just stay with the tennis group? And they're like, okay, that's actually a good way. I'm like, it just casts your net out wider.
Yeah, exactly. I love that. And I'm laughing because I probably said that to you a decade ago. And but as a true story, I'm a tennis player. My partner, Michelle, is a golfer. And we both laugh because we're like, but I have people I play tennis with. She has people she golfs with. And and it works. And occasionally we take the other one, but I'm not a very good golfer and that's okay. And I don't, I'll drive the golf cart. But what we do in each other's lives isn't everything. And I think we know that for one of the great changes in relationships in recent decades is this sense of this, what Eli Finkel calls the all or nothing marriage, this desire that our partners can do everything, meet all of our needs. And it's unrealistic. And I think one of the things that age can help us with is not having that unrealistic expectation that your partner can't meet all your needs. And you shouldn't expect them to. But diversifying those needs. I love how you put it, Bella. So have your tennis club. Your partner doesn't need to be your tennis club. They have to be your partner.
Right. We don't have to have mirror images of ourselves, right? And
you know, I kill myself. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't like that about myself, right? And we do. It's, you know, if you think about generations past, did our grandparents say, I'm looking for my soulmate, my best friend, my lover? We need to play tennis together and golf. No, they're like, well, you know, she was there. He was there. Mm-hmm. We were about the right age. My aunt knew his cousin. So we got married. Right? It's like he did this and I did this. And so I think our expectations have gotten higher and higher of what we want and what we need out of our partners.
That's absolutely right. And
we haven't changed as humans.
No, there's still the same architectures there. But our worlds are more complex. Our social lives are more complex, for good and bad, than ever before. But you're absolutely right. We, even with all that complexity and more noise and more social interaction and different types of work, that core that what we really want from our partners is someone to connect with, someone to weather the storm with. And in fact, I think that was a great takeaway of COVID. When I think about the impact of the pandemic on people's intimate lives, the thing that I'm most struck with is that for so many people, they realized they wanted someone to weather the storm with. We went through the great storm. And that's the reason pair bonds evolved 4 million years ago, as our friend Helen Fisher often talks about, is to have someone through to weather adversity with. And I think we've seen that. And actually, I think it's actually changed relationships pretty drastically in the United States, at least, where we have the best, where our group has some good data, that people seem a little bit more interested in someone getting to know partners on dating, a little bit more focus on intentional dating, on long-term commitment, on someone that they think can be there in time of need. I started my career writing about hookups and casual sex. And people are certainly still engaging in hookups, but there's a lot more attention than I think 5 years ago to really meaningful, intentional dating and forming partnerships, because we've all went through this global trauma and we realize the benefit of those close bonds to our survival and thriving.
Yeah. It's like, I don't want to do that alone again. Right. There's so many people, right? And the dating apps had unprecedented growth in 2020. Right? It's a good time to own Match's stock or anybody's stock at that point, because when you're stuck by yourself, there's no more brunching with your pals or going to the gym. And I say it and I just get the heaves, like, oh God, I never want to go back to that again. But what did people do? They turned to the apps, right? And yeah. So, I mean, we have people that met and married, you know, through connections that they made on various apps through COVID. And sometimes they didn't meet each other in person for 3 to 4 months because some of them were caring for aging parents and couldn't take the risk. So interesting that we're talking about aging. So why don't you tell us, Justin, tell us about You know, you're the ED at the Kinsey Institute. And for those of you who don't know what the Kinsey Institute is, it's the foremost research authority on sex and relationships, or correct me on that.
Yeah, that's right. And the Institute was founded in 1947 here at Indiana University. So, and close to you, not too far. And we, it is a hub for research on sexuality and relationships. So we publish about 100 academic articles per year. It's quite a lot for a group. And we have, what's really exciting about the mission of the Institute is it doesn't intend to be a department in a university in the sense that, you know, we have to surround create a curriculum, but instead it's that you can run up and down the hall and there's a biologist, there's a neuroscientist, there's a sociologist, there's a psychologist, there's an anthropologist.
Amazing.
And there's all these different experts working on different aspects of sex and sexuality and relationships with their theories and their methods. And what we do is we pull them all together and we say, how do we have enough of a group, big enough group, with enough talent and expertise to really tackle all these big questions about everything from sexual assault to orgasm to our intimate relationships over time. So it's and on top of the research program, we also have the largest collection of sexuality related materials in the world. So we artwork, artifacts, manuscripts, all sorts of things that tell a story about the role of sex and sexuality in people's lives over thousands of years in every corner of the globe.
Amazing. And you have such an amazing background, Justin, in doing what you're doing. Tell us just some of the most interesting things that you've learned maybe about relationships, or interesting things that you're working on right now that our audience would be like, wait, what? That's amazing.
Sure. I'm really fortunate because I have such amazing colleagues and we work on so many different aspects of people's lives. One of the things I'm actually quite optimistic about is in our Singles in America study, the big study we do with Match every year, we've asked people a lot about first dates and going on, getting to know someone. Then we asked them about second dates. And I've become almost a zealot over second dates, that I think of how important they are and how much information we can gain. And Marcus, first dates were often nervous. We're making snap judgments. It's awkward. You don't know how to say goodbye. What we found in our most recent data was that 49% of people have fallen in love with someone they weren't initially attracted to. And that's a huge number of people that, although we all have a sense that we should trust our gut, and I think there are times that we should trust our gut. If you feel unsafe, uncomfortable, trust your gut. Your body's telling you something. But I think we sometimes put too much emphasis on those first impressions, because we know that getting to know someone and getting to care for someone, to love someone, that takes time and it takes more information than, you know, maybe an initial 45-minute coffee date would get you. So I think one of the things I like from the data is that we can see these really optimistic turns and how people are getting to know each other. So that's one of my favorite, the 49% of people.
That's amazing. I just wrote it down. 40. And we, you know, we always say, you know, treat dating like you would a fine bottle of wine, like let it breathe, go on multiple dates, right? Yeah. And you never know that chemistry and attraction doesn't have to happen right away. It can grow over time. And so I love that the data show that as well.
Yeah. And I love how you frame it. And that's right. Like, it's a fine bottle of wine, let it breathe. You don't want to waste it. These are some of the most important decisions of our lives and we shouldn't rush them. On top of that, we've asked people some of the most important characteristics they want. What are they most attracted to, and looking for in a partner? And I think to your point, Bella, when we look at those, it's not things that you can really learn instantly. So what we asked in our most recent year, we asked people a whole host of things. And interestingly, physical attraction isn't in the top five. It was in the top five 10 years ago, but not any longer. And the top five items, the number one thing people look for is someone that they can trust and confide in. The next one was someone who's emotionally mature. Next was someone who can make them laugh. Then someone who's comfortable with their own sexuality. And last, someone who's comfortable communicating their wants and needs. And for me, that tells such a beautiful story about why second dates, third dates are important, because those are things that we learn over time as we get to interact with people. Some of that you can maybe pick up on a first date if they make you laugh, or but you're probably not going to get all of that information right away. So those are the things we want most in partners. That takes, got to let that wine bottle breathe to learn all that information.
Interesting. And that's what the data showed for Match. It's like, not only did 49% of us not really find our eventual mate attractive in the beginning, but these are the top five things that the majority of people are saying that they want out of a relationship.
Exactly. And that's from our single study that we do. It's a national demographically representative sample. So it's not users of a particular dating app or site. It's a national panel that we collect every year, a little over 5,000 people every year for 13 years now.
That's amazing. Wow, I love that. And tell me, what are some of the hottest topics right now in that you're researching in sex right now? And you also told me something interesting about aging and a study in Cosmos. So let's go to both of these things, because I'm fascinated by all of it.
I love it. I always love when we're together. There's so much to talk about. And the I could start on the aging one. And I think this is one of the big topics of this time, in part because of populations are aging, right? The baby boomers are aging. We're learning a lot about, there's more emphasis on aging, understanding the difference between sort of your age in years and your biological age. So some people, as we know, age faster or slower than others. My own friends are all talking about going to anti-aging doctors, you know, and is how we think about this process in our lives, but particularly its impact on people's romantic and sexual lives. And I think more than ever, it's funny, we just returned from Thanksgiving. When I used to be in the classroom, I used to teach my relationship class, I would always tell my students in the fall, when you go home for Thanksgiving, ask your parents and your grandparents and your aunts and uncles about love and sex. And my students would say, are you crazy? We're going to talk about this. Is it, you know, tell me about your first love.
Pass the gravy.
But I actually think it's such an important conversation for people who are comfortable to have it, because they can learn so much about the people around them, what worked and what didn't work, or the regrets or the that they may or may not have. So what we're finding is that it's an interesting case of why we need to really explore data. You need to look under the hood. So on average, if you just throw the data in, you would say as people age, their sexual frequency declines. Their interest in sex declines. But it turns out if you look at that data a little more carefully, if you control for things like medication use, particularly medications that we take when we're older, like cardiovascular drugs, if you control for those, that slope of decline sexual frequency with age is not nearly as steep. So a lot of what we see is decreased sexual frequency is because of things in our life, our lifestyle, our weight, our medication use, that is impacting that rate, that slope of decline. But also we're seeing generations that have access to pharmaceutical drugs in a way that past generations didn't. So what we're seeing in our data, including this new collaboration the Kinsey Institute did with Cosmo Magazine, it'll be out in January, available online. It's actually a digital special issue we're doing on the golden age of sex, is really looking at how we can kind of overturn some of the myths we have about aging and sex. And we're seeing that people in their 60s, 70s, 80s, still sexually active, still going on dates, often looking for different things. One of my favorite findings from some of our studies on aging and sex was actually on orgasm. And although as we age, we know that on average, sexual frequency can decline, sexual function can decline, particularly for men with sort of any issues around erectile function with age. But what we found for orgasm was that for both men and women, even though frequency of sex acts decreased with age, their orgasm rates didn't decrease. In fact, there was a slight uptick in the orgasm rates with advanced age. And we really thought about why that could be. And I think partly what's going on, especially in women, is as people age, they start to realize what works for them and what doesn't work for them. But in the cases of women, and we can think about the menopausal transition and what happens to our bodies, what happens to estrogen, what happens to the thinning of the vaginal wall, what happens to the whole way our whole bodies function with respect to sex and sexuality, well, sometimes sex is slower. It's more intentional. There's more foreplay. Now, our friends who are sex therapists would be telling 20-year-olds you should be doing more foreplay too. But in some ways, out of necessity, as we get older, people are doing things that are positively associated with pleasure outcomes. So we're seeing in these people in our sample who are 85 and their orgasm rates are fairly consistent with people who are 30, even though that their frequency of sex acts. So actually, you might argue that their sort of orgasm per sex rate is higher at these later ages in life. The really interesting nuances in the data. And same on dating. We're seeing in these older samples, people who are dating. I think you and I were talking not long ago about the Golden Bachelor and the sort of there's a sort of renaissance of appreciating that people who are dating in later life, and they look for different things. They look for a kind of companionship and in ways that sometimes people in their 20s don't. So having the data to see all that and how that changes in our life course and what we want has been really a fun collaboration.
I love that. I mean, a significant, you know, probably, I don't know, 30, 40% of our clients are singles over 50. And I know at 50, you can get an AARP card. So I don't know if people are golden at 50, but all I know is 50 to 75-year-olds are dating just as often as our 34 and 36-year-olds. And they're often having the best sex of their lives.
Yeah. And I love it. And it's in many ways, because you're at a different point in your life in that age group, some of the concerns you had when you were younger about your body or about finances even, and things like going on dates. We see in some of our data, people in their 30s, some of them are really worried about what they spend on a date. And a lot of our older samples, they kind of have a handle on that. They have a better sense of their budget. They have a better sense of who they are and who they aren't. So it really is a golden age thinking about our intimate selves.
I love that. I love that. And anything else that's, you know, hot and heavy and new in the sexual world?
Oh, there's all sorts of topics. There's exciting ones about things like relationship context of our sex lives. So there's been a lot of focus on research on understanding people's experiences. And how does that vary in your most recent relationship sex versus your hookup casual sex versus solo sex with yourself and no one else? So relationship context could be nobody, but what do our sex lives look like? In fact, one of the interesting findings from our COVID studies we did, the Kinsey Institute did probably the largest multinational study on the impact of the pandemic on people's sexual lives. My colleagues, Amanda Gesselman, Justin LaMiller, and Kristen Mark, and one analysis, we found that sexual frequency went down during the pandemic, but what was interesting is masturbation rates went down. And for us as researchers, that's a measure that says, well, actually, your interest in anything sexual, it wasn't just that you couldn't access partners because we were on lockdown. It was that your interest in sex had decreased. And what we think may have been going on is that for a lot of people, they were psychologically in a threat response. And that's not conducive to mating psychology. I often joke and say, well, you know, you would never see two gazelle mating in front of a lion. And if we're in that kind of response, we don't, you know, you don't stop to kiss in a burning building. And you sort of, that's the brain needs to feel safe in order to engage in social and sexual interactions in meaningful ways.
That's so interesting. That's so well put, right? We were sort of in threat situation, fight or flight, and you didn't want to have sex really, period.
Yeah, exactly. And then what we found is a little later on, though, people started getting inventive. So then once there was a sense of, like, we knew what we needed, people had a sense of how to survive and we knew a little bit more. So we found 1 in 5 people during the pandemic tried something new in their sex life. So although the rates were down, the diversity was up. People were just sort of trying new things in their lives. Although I still remember I talked to interviewed one couple, and they said during the pandemic, we started having shower sex. And I said, oh, this confirms our data. Well, 20% of people. And the woman said to me, well, we started having shower sex because it was the only place we could get away from the kids for a few minutes. So it's also a reminder that diversity was sometimes out of necessity. of people being creative in the living situations during the pandemic.
That's so interesting and so funny. And, you know, I've been seeing on the dating apps and hearing people talking about consensual non-monogamy or ethical non-monogamy. Like, what do you think this means, you know, on the apps for people and relationships going forward? It's so interesting to me.
Yeah, it is. And it's, we've really seen a surge in people talking about it, putting it on their apps, disclosing their interest, which I think is great. I think if you're interested in non-monogamy, disclosing it early on is a great thing to do. We, in one of our studies we published, we found that about 1 in 5 Americans have at some point had a consensually non-monogamous relationship. And that can include anything from being monogamish to being swingers or to being an open relationship, being polyamorous. And they're all a little bit different. Polyamorous is plural love. That means you have multiple romantic bonds. An open sexual relationship might mean that you have one primary romantic bond, but you have multiple sexual partners. And individuals and couples often have different arrangements of how they make that work for them. So pretty high rates, though. 1 in 5 people, as my colleague Amy Moore is at Chapman will always say, that's about as common as people who own a cat in the U.S. So if you know someone who owns a cat, you probably know someone who's been in an open relationship.
And those are the people that admit to it.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Right. So I always say if we say it's 1 in 5, it's probably 2 in 5. Yeah.
It could be. Exactly. And it could be because and even I think what's interesting is in some of the studies, you can ask people about their relationships. And they said, well, I was dating someone and then I was also seeing someone else and they both knew, but I was never poly. I was never in an open relationship. But and then so sometimes we also have versions of our reality. And I think that's why it's so important as researchers, the questions we ask. Your point's so spot on, Bella, right? We can ask a question and not really get the right data that you think you're getting because a person might not conceptualize what they did as being consensually non-monogamous. Same thing, the Kinsey Institute researchers have a method for asking people about their sexual activity. And what we don't always realize is if you just ask someone, have you had sex? People answer that question very differently. For some people, it means penetrative intercourse. For some people, they have to orgasm. For some people, the way a lesbian couple answers that might not be the same behavior described by a gay man or heterosexual people. So the behaviors can be different. So we'll ask very specific questions. So same with this one. But on the non-monogamy front, there's a lot more research happening on it. I think there's more acceptance of it. Actually, researchers often use the term relationship diversity now to better understand that people structure their relationships in lots of different ways. There isn't a one size that fits all. But what's interesting about the non-monogamy, the consensual non-monogamy, which is just totally distinct from infidelity, is that although a lot of people try it, that 1 in 5 at least, have tried it, a much smaller percentage stay in those relationships. So there's still a lot of social pressure for people to form kind of so-called monogamous bonds, right? To form a relationship with one person that's sexually exclusive. And most people in the U.S., and in fact, most people internationally, those are what our relationships tend to look like.
That's so interesting that you say people start it. And if I followed you correctly, it's social pressure pushes them back to conformity of being with one person. I'm wondering, is it you open up your relationship? So you're both open to dating other people. Does that make you realize, wow, I really don't like knowing that my husband is sleeping with other people? Mm-hmm. And how much of that plays into saying, yeah, I don't love this because how do I know you're not going to fall in love with someone else, which then gets to trust issues, and trust is the fundamental of a relationship.
Exactly. And that's why what we see is people structure these in different ways that can work for them. And sometimes there are some people who they have an open relationship, but the expression is play together, right? So that they engage in threesomes, but they have to both be there so that they have this open type of relationships, but not independently. They're still both there. Other people, have a don't ask, don't tell. We might have rules. If you're with someone else, you have to use condoms, you have to use birth control, you have to, maybe you don't see the person a second time. They can't be someone we're both friends with. People have all sorts of rules of how to structure it. And all of those rules, what they're really designed for is to manage human emotion. They manage jealousy. Because we all do, on average, or most of us do get jealous about our relationships. There is a possessiveness that happens in relationship psychology. Happens in other animals too. I remember once being on a hike and watching two red-winged blackbirds that were a mated pair for the season. And the male flew off, and then another male came in and tried to mate with the female. And she was fine with it. She's having a fine day. But then her primary partner returned, and the two males fought, and they grappled with each other, and they fell into the reeds in this pond. And only one came out. One of them drowned the other one. And it was such a great insight, a reminder that in the natural world, including in human relationships, there tends to be a possessiveness over our partnerships. That's the person I love. That's the person I invested in. That's the person who loves me. And it can be difficult to share that. And in fact, I think we all have a lot to learn from people who are engaged in consensual non-monogamy, of how they manage that jealousy, of how they negotiate it, how they talk through it. The fact that it doesn't work for everyone who tries it is also telling, that there's a subset of people it works really well for. And I think we can all learn from them, but it doesn't mean that it's a one size fit all. It doesn't mean that's something other people should try or need to try or want to try.
And to that point, if you see somebody talking about consensual non-monogamy on a dating app, you know, it means that this person is saying, I don't want to be in a monogamous relationship now or in the future. And if you're looking for one lid to your pot, I might not be the person for you. That's how we should read that.
Exactly. And I mean, I think sometimes people change, but as you know, as you advise people, you don't want to get into a relationship with the expectation you can change someone's views. And, but I think that's right. And especially the challenge could be if you know you want one person and you find someone on an app, or you meet someone who says, I'm interested in consensual non-monogamy, or I'm poly, is being real with ourselves about, for a lot of people, there is overwhelming jealousy. That can be really difficult. And I don't think that should stop people from trying and exploring things, but that's a pretty big emotional lift for a lot of people to say, I'm going to start a new relationship and know I'm not the only one. And you can set yourself up for a lot of hurt. In some ways, the way psychologists describe and define romantic love, it's focused attention, intrusive thought, obsessive thinking. The brain focuses in on one individual. That is to share that. And the people that have an ability to sort of diversify that feeling, that doesn't come easy to most people. And in fact, the anthropological literature from all over the globe would say it's not a pattern that people tend to engage in. There are some that can. And sometimes it's based on resources, family dynamics, your own psychology. Yeah, exactly. But it's not, it doesn't work for everybody.
Yeah, 100%. So it was funny as we were thinking about this. I'm like, well, my clients are all dating multiple people in the beginning until they narrow it down to one. So it's not really consensual non-monogamy in the beginning. It's just dating. But ultimately, you're dating with the purpose to find one partner. And that's where the difference is.
Yeah, exactly.
I always tell people, assume everybody's dating everybody in the beginning. Nobody's exclusive until you've had that conversation.
Oh, every college student on our campuses needs to hear that. We need to get you a megaphone. And you're so right, because often I'll hear from students sometimes and they'll say, well, we're hanging out for 6 months and
we're talking.
And sometimes those terms like boyfriend, girlfriend, or whatever terms we use, it puts some boundaries on the expectations of where we are. And having those conversations that I know you always encourage folks, and I love it, is to say, like, you know, there comes a point where you have to check in and say, where are we? What are we? And we're all entitled to ask those questions. And in fact, what we know in the research is people are often afraid. We've asked this before. People are often afraid to ask that question, but mostly everyone respects it. They understand that there comes a point that you need to ask it. They might think you're asking it too soon, but we all realize that that is a conversation that's prudent for us to have in relationships.
Oh, absolutely. I always say, ask the question, right? And you don't want a date to feel like a deposition, but what you said in the top five things that, you know, singles in America show that match singles want, or not match singles, all singles that are in the survey, was being able to articulate your wants and needs. Okay. Now, if that's sexy and that's something everybody wants, it's okay to use your voice and ask the question, right? Just yesterday, I had a client who was in our photo studio getting her photos done, and she's on a dating app right now. And we're going to obviously relaunch all of her stuff. But she said, Bella, I see a guy on here that says, you know, in the relationship category, he doesn't know what he's looking for. But other than that, everything looks nice. I find him attractive. His profile was nice. And I said to her, ask him the question. Hey, you look great. Curious. Did you, you know, what does it mean that you don't know, you know, what you're looking for in a relationship or dating? Ask him. And then you can, rather than immediately saying, I'm going to throw you to the gutter, he might not know what he wants next week, but he might, or he might ask the question. What do you have to lose? You might be swiping left on your soulmate. You don't know.
Yeah.
Ask the question. Worst case scenario is they'll block you, delete you, or left swipe you. Who cares? What do you have to lose? Nothing.
Exactly. And I love it for a lot of reasons, including that rather than filling in the information that we think what it means, just ask and find out. And that's so, I mean, that's part of the whole search process to find a partner, a mate, is we have to learn more information. And there could be, maybe they just skip the question. Maybe it's complicated. Maybe it's something you can live with. Maybe it's something you can't. But asking and getting to know is important. And it might not come out right away, but on that second date, it will. That's why you have to go on the second date.
Right. And if somebody says they're looking for something casual, but you're looking for something serious, ask about that. And then you can decide on the second date or the third date. Exactly. You know what? We just want different things. If you're, you know, post-divorce and looking for casual and you just want to kiss a bunch of people right now because you haven't been on a date since 1987, that's fine, right? And that person may not be a good relationship bet for you right now, but you won't know it until you ask the question.
Yeah, I love it.
And people don't usually lie.
No, no, because we're all, especially in some ways, what's interesting about the apps, if you meet someone, I think, particularly if you meet someone through a matchmaker or on an app, it means you're kind of actively in the process. So people sometimes stretch their truth in terms of a picture is a couple of years old or how much they weigh. But in terms of those big fundamentals, we really don't have a lot of evidence that people are lying about that because they're doing the same thing we're doing. And I actually think in all my years of research, I think the biggest takeaway about courtship, signs of courtship, is our reminder that it's a two-person dance, and that we, just as we're out there trying to figure out who could be a good match for us and collect information, other people are out there looking at us and saying, are we a good match? So it's that back and forth, that there's two people, that it's not just, hey, I'm on the app looking for someone that interests me. You also have to say, do I have enough information on my profile that could interest you? Because it's that two-way street, that it's not just what we're looking for, that we give enough out to the world for someone to find us.
Yeah, absolutely. And connect with. And speaking of, Justin, dating apps and technologies, I mean, dating apps, as you and I know, you know, every week, it seems like they're falling under some new scrutiny. Like, what do you see right now as the problems, the solutions? Like, where do you think we're going to go with dating apps?
Yeah, I think I'm overall optimistic. And I think that in dating, I think part of the challenge is if we think that the apps are going to find us the love of our life, that could happen, but that's not really the promise of the technology. What the technology does is helps us connect with people, helps us find people. And then everything from there, it's connection, it's the human brain, it's the dating process, it's the timing. One of my colleagues, Chris Agnew, has written a lot about timeliness. And sometimes someone is perfect, but the timing is just wrong. Like where you are in your careers or family stuff, or you're moving. You have to, you know, work on different schedules. So there's all those just real time issues that come up in our dating lives. That happens after you meet someone. So I think if we look at the apps and the websites as ways to connect, it's an extraordinary opportunity. You can find people with similar interests, similar backgrounds, same region, whatever it is that you need in a partner. And that's quite unique, especially for certain groups. Like if you are a religious group that you really want to date someone of that same religion, LGBTQ populations, for instance, they actually use the apps at roughly twice the rate. In part, it's a lot safer in a lot of parts of the country to use an app to meet someone than to walk into your local bar. And so I think there's some realities around things like that, that it's just a wonderful opportunity. And I think if you really fill out your profile, it also makes you, as a user, think about the things that you want. It's the same as why I always encourage people to go to dating coaches, right? It's sort of like, it can help you really think about what is it that you're really looking for? What is it that you really want to think about? You know, what you want in the market, what's your goal here? And just talking through that and thinking through that. So I think that's the great opportunity. We do know that more people are meeting through apps and websites than any other context. It's the most common way singles are meeting, and that's been true for over a decade. Most common way singles meet their partner. I think the challenge is that it's a technology a lot of us don't know how to handle and use. And you can go on and see all these people. And one of the tricks is that once you find someone that interests you, you have to kind of, you don't have to do anything, you do what you want, but it's good to really invest in that interaction. And an interaction isn't going to go anywhere. A relationship's not going to go anywhere unless you invest in the one in front of you. So if you message someone and you say, well, I like this, but there's something here, but there's still another 1,500 people I can get through before lunch. You don't actually ever cultivate something to see if there could be a spark, if there could be a connection. So we have to, I think the challenge with the apps is it feels sometimes like a game, and we forget that courtship requires our investment of time, energy, resources to really see if that person is there. You can't have one foot out the door the whole time. You can't be out for lunch saying, well, this is okay, but it's not great, and I'll find someone else before dinner on the app. So if we really want to progress it, we need to kind of get into it. And sometimes it's just the information. It's why some of the apps, but some of the companies know this, which is really interesting. They understand the behavioral science. It's why some try to slow you down. They say, here's three to really look at today. Or here's, now as you go through the profile, you see picture information. All of that is to try and slow us down to focus a little bit more on the person in front of us.
Yeah, no, I love that. It's like the paralysis of choice, right? When you feel like you've got 1,500 potential matches, it becomes so easy. Even when you go out on a date, you know, and you meet this person in real life, it's like, you know, it was meh. Let's see who's on, you know, let's see, it was kind of boring. Let's see who else is in my lineup. It's like, hold on a second, right? That is absolutely just having too much choice, right? And we're like dating with one eye open to see who's coming down the pike. So one way that we manage it is I have our clients only on two apps, and they're constrained on time, 15 minutes in the morning, 15 minutes in the evening, being conscious, being mindful, so that you don't gamify it too much where people and these connections feel disposable, right? And invest 15 minutes, and maybe you're messaging five people, but read their profile, write something interesting, or respond in a way that is interesting to the other person. Like a good rapport, even with messaging, is like a tennis match. You hit the ball back and forth. And so I'm with you. I think there are a lot of great things about the apps. And I feel like over at least my tenure with Smart Dating Academy, the apps have only gotten better, but the apps are not matchmakers. The apps are giving you access to people you would never find in your real life. Like, would you have really come across Michelle without a dating app?
No, we were living in different cities. We have so many things in common, but we probably just would have never ran into each other.
Right. Right. 100%. So love is always going to come to you in an unexpected package, most likely from an unexpected place as well. So I know that is the case in my relationship. It sounds like that's the case in your relationship as well.
That's right. And it's wonderful for it. I mean, that opportunity, and it's an opportunity, that opportunity to find someone who can enrich our your lives, enrich my life, enrich your life. And because of sometimes fortuitous moments. And I love your guidance that I really thinking about how to use the app smartly. And that's what we all need. We need tools to think about how to use this technology to leverage it, not to let it control us, not to be on it all day, not to get depressed about it. And the other thing I think on that is people will say to me all the time, well, I'm on the app. I couldn't find anyone. And these apps are really terrible. I can't find a partner. And I often think to myself, you know, I've studied courtship in a lot of different countries. And I think, what do you think it was like before the apps? Courtship has always been rough. It has always been difficult. It is one of the most important decisions people will make in their life. And sometimes we make it multiple times. Most people make it more than once. And that's not designed in terms of culture or evolved, adapted in terms of our deep biology to be an easy or simple decision. So I think that we sometimes have to remember that the apps didn't introduce that that complexity that's always there in terms of making those decisions. But I love your point about, you know, give yourself time, focus in, and get to know someone and see what's there.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. And, you know, I was looking at some of the notes I had before this. I mean, talk a little bit, you know, and I think we touched on this earlier, but the role of sex in healthy and satisfying relationships. We talk about it from an aging perspective, right? And sometimes, you know, couples I know, even personally, it's like, well, how many times a week should we be having sex? Like, is there any data around this?
Yeah, I love it. And I think there's two ways we can think about that and two important answers we can all remember. And one is the best amount of sex for people is the amount you're comfortable with. And I know that might seem sort of cheeky on the one hand, but in fact, there are some couples who report really high sexual and relationship satisfaction. And we know that sexual satisfaction and relationship satisfaction are highly correlated. In fact, in all the big meta-analyses on divorce, one of the strongest predictors of divorce are people's sex lives. And I always think it's a little entertaining to me when people forget that, because we say we need to think about sex and relationships. Sometimes I'll joke with my colleagues, say, if we want to keep families together, we need to think about, you know, sex. And but in fact, our sex lives have a major impact on our relationship satisfaction and stability. And for some people, it's because they use sex as a weather vane. If they're not having sex, they think, okay, there's something else going on in our relationship. I'm unhappy. You're unhappy. We're working too hard. You know, whatever it could be. The reality is couples fluctuate throughout their life and individuals fluctuate in their sort of sexual interest and desire. And sometimes it could be down for a long time. It could be down for a couple of weeks, comes back up. But one of the things we know from the data is great studies. My colleague Amy Muse at York University has done these really beautiful studies looking at the role of sex in long-term couples. And in one of them, she found that if you have sex about once a week, that there's a sort of a glass seal, there's a ceiling effect, and that you, whether you have sex once a week or four times a week, there doesn't seem to be a big difference on its impact on relationship and sexual satisfaction. So now if you're less than that rate of once a week, then those couples are, then it can start to feel spread out. So the number, the sort of research-based number, is if you're roughly in the range of once a week, you're kind of maximizing your potential for sexual satisfaction based on frequency. There's other things that impact satisfaction, like the particular behaviors, pleasure, orgasm, pain, you know, different things of communication with your partner. So I think on the one hand, the answer is what works for you and your partner or your partners, if you're consensually And then the other is research would suggest that once you're at about once a week, you're kind of maxing out the impact of frequency on satisfaction.
I love that glass ceiling. There's so many things you've said I'm going to start quoting. I love this, Justin. You're amazing. I'm so blown away by you as always and grateful. Justin and I met during COVID, right? We did an NPR Zoom event together, right?
That's right.
At night. It was like NPR After Dark or something.
That's right. I forgot. Yeah. And we've been, I think for years, we've been in similar circles. We have so many friends and colleagues, but it was fun to finally be able to do something together.
Right. Our very good mutual friend, Dr. Lauren Stryker, has been on this podcast. And for those of you who might be in that golden population listening to this, Lauren, one of my favorite things about her is she will tell you sex should not be painful. And if it is, there are remedies. And if the people that you're seeing can't fix that, you're not seeing the right people.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, as you say, so Lauren's a good friend of both of ours. And we, as a physician, as a OBGYN, I'm always struck when I talk to her about how many physicians aren't trained on sexuality. And it's a great issue of when we think, like, who do you go to talk about your sex life? And I think a lot of people just assume I'll talk to my doctor. Well, turns out most physicians get 1 hour of training on sex. They get 30 minutes on male sexual dysfunction and 30 minutes on female sexual dysfunction. You know, there are people who specialize, like Lauren Stryker and others, who sort of do specialize in issues of sexual medicine or menopause but I think often there's a sense of when it comes to, and I think it's the same with relationships, right? And as you know, there are people who are experts. You can go to a dating coach, you can go to a sex therapist, you can talk to a sexologist, that even though love and sex are part of all of our lives, the reality is that your typical physician or therapist or coach might not have those tools. There are people that specialize in these issues, and they're complex, and there's a lot of data, and there's a lot of noise, and we have to seek those out. And I like, as you said, you put it beautifully, you know, if you're not getting answers, you got to find someone who will help you with those.
Yeah, absolutely. And Justin, anything I haven't asked you or any last gems you want to drop on our listener?
No, this is so great. I'm honored. Thank you for having me on. It's always great to be with you. And it was great honor to be with you and your listeners. And I would invite everyone to visit the Kinsey Institute, whether it's our website or on Instagram. We post things about our art and we post fun facts from our research or in person here at Indiana University.
You guys, we're going to have a big meetup of smart daters and we're going to go tour the Kinsey Institute. How awesome would that be?
I love it. I will do the tour myself. I love it.
I'm telling you guys, if you don't follow the Kinsey Institute, support the Kinsey Institute in this crazy climate of defunding. Make sure you give the site a whirl if you feel called to it. Certainly donate, sponsor. What can people do, Justin?
Exactly. We really welcome people to sign up for our newsletter on the Kinsey Institute website. And to follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Our Instagram we're putting more emphasis on that, and including sharing things from the collections, our artwork, our data findings. And the Institute is about a third funded philanthropically. So folks that are interested in whether they're tax deductible gifts to the Institute as a nonprofit at a higher ed organization, but also if there's things that people are interested in around love and sex and they want to be partners with us in terms of creating educational programs or supporting research studies or naming curators after them, we really value partnerships and people who help us do transformative things in our understanding of love, sex, intimacy today and deep into the future.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for being with us. I'm grateful.
Thank you, Bella.
Smart daters, I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. And if you need some help, you need some inspiration, follow the Kinsey Institute, follow Smart Dating Academy on Instagram, fill out our contact form to get our newsletter so you can be in the know of everything that's going on. And if you need a consultation, send us an email and we'll get you set up. So until next week, I bid you farewell and have a psychotically optimistic and beautiful week. Thanks for listening. And as always, download us, share us, show us the love. Follow Instagram at Smart Dating Academy. And if you or someone you know wants to learn more, check out our website at smartdatingacademy.com. We're here to bring you love.